I'm Karen Blomquist, and this is the third session in the series Work, Justice, and the Church. And today our theme is What's Happening to Work? And that's one of the reasons that I'm hoping we can make it a participatory kind of discussion, because I see all of us as being authorities on this subject. I want to lay out some things first. First of all, to catch up those of you who've come into this in the middle, or some of you who are still kind of wondering, well, what is she in the process of doing anyway, or where is she coming from, etc. And so therefore, without going into too much detail with the whole process or the whole method or the whole way in which I'm trying to understand some contemporary realities theologically, I thought I'd put this little circle up here. Last time we talked about the good life circle. This is a different kind of circle, and an attempt to theologically understand what's going on in our world today. And it's something that I draw on a lot, and I think underlies a lot of how I do theology, how I try to make some connections between the church and the world and all that sort of thing. The first step is asking the question, what's going on with folks? And here is where I think we need to really open all of our senses, you know, to see, to hear, to feel, to say, you know, not just what am I told people are experiencing, but what do I hear people in our congregation, in our society, in whatever arena expressing. And a lot of that may be nonverbal stuff. You know, what do we sense people are feeling, even though they may not always say it that way? And that was part of my attempt to begin to get into some of the kinds of stuff that I think people feel as they find themselves caught up in that whole circle of the American dream and of the good life circle and all that sort of thing. The second question, or the second part of this on the right-hand side, why is it like this, is the primary question there. And that leads us into various forms of social analysis, of trying to say, okay, how do we not just take the surface of what people are expressing, but how do we dig a little deeper and say, hey, what's really going on there? What are the forces that are shaping those things that people are feeling? And I think it is at that point that we begin to discern, you know, some of the wider institutional corporate realities that, in the case of our topic this week, impinge on the world of work. And we need to be cognizant of that. Now, that's not in any way an easy kind of step, because it's very difficult for us to really get handles on what all is going on. But I think church folk have been pretty naive when it comes to that point. And we've said, well, you know, we can just say, well, this is what's hurting people, and then we'll somehow do what needs to be done in order to put some Band-Aids on at that point. And sometimes our strategies then are very naive, because they don't take into consideration some of these wider corporate realities that are impinging on what people experience. And it's that kind of thing that I'm hoping, that I'm trying to get us involved in, not in a complete sense, but at least beginning to raise some of those questions in order to understand more deeply what's going on with folks. Now, it's out of that that this third step on the bottom of the circle begins to emerge. And I think it's the most crucial step for us as Christians. And it's one where I think we have to do a lot more grappling than we've normally done. Namely to say, or to raise the question, how do we begin to understand the Bible, our theological symbols, how do we begin to make the theological connections with this reality that we've begun to explore and understand more deeply over here? How do we begin to understand what sin might mean in the relationship to that? Not just sin as individual acts of wrongdoing, but sin as a power of domination, as that which seems to entrap us and makes us feel very powerless and apathetic, and et cetera, the kinds of stuff we were talking about in the first session or two. Not only what is sin, or what are the powers and principalities, but what's good news? How do we begin to sense an inbreaking of God's grace, an inbreaking of gospel in the midst of that? What does that mean? And that's where I think there's some real connection with some of the kind of spirituality kinds of stuff that John's been talking about. But then out of that flows the fourth, and in some ways the most crucial step. What needs to be done differently in light of a theological understanding of our reality? How do we begin to act differently in light of what the Bible and our understanding of the symbols of our faith tell us in relationship to that reality that we find ourselves in? How do we begin to become part of the solution rather than the problem? What does it mean to begin to embody a different lifestyle, different ministry, a different praxis, to use a fancier word? What does it mean to begin to shape a new church for our children? In other words, it's at this point that we move toward that familiar phrase at least one of the stories of Jesus. What does it mean to take up our bed and to walk? And it's at this third step that we say, hey, you know, we've been grasped by God's grace, we've been empowered by God's Spirit, and therefore we do have that kind of power to envision alternatives to how things are and to begin living in some different ways. It's at that point where I think we're really tested to see whether, in fact, our faith can engage us in that struggle against objective cynicism, the phrase that I shared with you on Monday. And so it's this whole kind of circle that is kind of underlying my attempt this week to understand some crucial things about the world of work. But as you can see, that's a very participatory kind of thing. That's not the kind of thing where a pastor or a theologian or an ethicist can somehow tell the people how it is. But it means people getting involved in that process. So that if you haven't discovered or suspected the connections already, this is a circle very similar to what liberation theologians in Latin America and a lot of other countries are doing. But part of my concern is finding ways in which that way of putting together things and understanding our life in relationship to our faith is extremely applicable to those of us who are middle Americans. It's not just a kind of theological process that Latin American peasants are engaged in, or that feminists are engaged in this country, although in both cases this process is somewhat similar. But to say, hey, how can that also become a meaningful way to go about things and to think theologically about our world for those of us who are, you know, kind of middle class, white Americans, and who have not often thought of our faith and our lives in that way. So that's just a preface to flesh out a little bit more where I'm coming from or how I'm trying to put some of this stuff together. In our last session, which was 2 days ago, we especially tried to look at the American dream and the way in which that really does become a kind of secular religion in our society, and not just something that folks apart from the church are caught up in, but something that very much permeates the understanding of those of us who are within the church too. And I think also infects the very way in which the church as an institution thinks of itself. When we think of the kind of status games that even go on in the church, you know, if you're a pastor, you know, you want that bigger and better church, and you know, if you stay in a place for 12 years, as one pastor I know did, and at the end of those 12 years was still earning $9,000, people kind of say, well, hey, what's wrong with this guy? You know, he somehow has not had the appropriate upward mobility kinds of aspirations that Americans are supposed to have, including those who work in and for the church. So it's an attempt to say, okay, why is it like this? And I tried to chart out some of the aspects of individualism and consumerism that are a part of that, and how those really begin to take over, so that some of the biblical understandings of what work is intended to be, the intrinsic worth of and meaning of work, the sense of vocation, the sense of stewardship, those aspects tend to get subverted by the whole good life cycle that we talked about on Tuesday. So under our present economic system, work generally is not experienced as that fulfilling, even though it is something that people crave as well as curse. But it is experienced as alienating in one way or another, and not as something over which one feels control or pride, not as something that one feels like an active agent in the midst of. And I think the bottom line in terms of some of the biblical stuff that I laid out on Monday is that I think the calling of the church and of church folk is to find ways to raise up that biblical vision, using that as a basis for challenging some of the patterns of work in our society. And in saying that, I don't want to be read as being too terribly naive on that, because I realize, we're talking about, an economic system that has shaped work in some very profound ways, and we can't just say, well, now we need fulfilling kind of work. But I think there's a long-term kind of agenda that the church, in coalition with other groups in our society, can begin to work for. One of the aspects of that American dream cycle that I didn't get into that much, but I think does play into another kind of diagram that I'm going to want to share with you this morning, is that even if people can't make it and don't achieve the promise of that American dream or the promise of the good life, one of the other dynamics that goes on, and I think this is particularly true for the kind of Germanic, Scandinavian groups that are so prominent within the Lutheran Church, is the whole business of sacrificing for one's kids. If I can't make it, at least I hope that my son and daughter will make it into the American dream. And I guess this means a lot to me because I'm quite aware of the fact that my father, who is now long deceased and was his highest level of education was eighth grade. He was a heating and sheet metal contractor. He eventually had his own business. And, he made sure that he was saving money from the year I was born so that his one and only child, would have a college education, etc. My mother says he'd probably turn over in his grave if he knew he went and became a minister or that he went on to get a PhD. But, in many ways, I guess I could say, I really got caught up in, I was really sent on that dynamic of, redeeming the sacrifice. There was a book that came out about 12 years ago called The Hidden Injuries of Class by Sennett and Cobb. I was delighted to hear that Janet Larson uses it in teaching English at Rutgers, as it really helps to understand some of the dynamics within working class culture. And that primary thing of sacrificing for one's kids with the hope that one's kids will redeem the sacrifice. Now the difficulty is that most of the time, us kids end up leaving the world of our parents. If not geographically, at least our values become quite different. So now when I go back to my mother, it's like, wow, I want you to kind of redeem those sacrifices that I made for you. But it's like you speak a language and have values that are so different that the meaning of how you've redeemed that sacrifice I've made, it doesn't compute. And I think, but anyway, that whole dynamic of sacrificing for the kids is something that I think is really being cast into a state of real crisis in our day. Because no longer are people able to count on that ever upwardly mobile kind of dynamic in terms of the kind of income, the kinds of jobs. Now, certainly for some, that continues to be the case. But for an increasing number, that's not the case. And therefore, the kind of cultural ethos that people have really bought, that we've really bought into, is being challenged and questioned and all kinds of disillusionment as to what that guarantees are beginning to emerge. certainly that upwardly mobile kind of striving is a striving so that one no longer will be so controlled. You know, if we think of jobs in the lower end of the labor sector being those that are very tightly controlled or closely controlled, certainly the idea is that as one moves up, as one gets more education, one is involved in work where there is likely to be more independence, more initiative, more self-pacing, you know, less of a sense of being controlled by the boss, etc. And so what I want to do is to share with you one person's attempt to understand what's happening to work, and especially to understand how control in the workplace has evolved, especially in this century. The book is by a fellow by the name of Richard Edwards, and it's called Contested Terrain. What he outlines in his book is the fact that the turn of the century and the first part of this century, the predominant form of control over the workplace that prevailed was that of simple, or what is sometimes called hierarchical, control. In other words, the control that a boss or an owner has over the workers is rather direct. You know, you work for so-and-so. You know, you work in so-and-so's shop. It's pretty informal, it's unstructured, but at the same time, you know who's the boss and who's the worker. You're hired to do such and such, and if you do a good job, usually you have some kind of a personal relationship with that boss, and you're working for him or for her, but these are jobs where, you know, usually it's not a unionized job, but you're working for some small business or shop or something like that. What has tended to happen, though, is that increasingly in this century, as companies grew bigger and as the labor process changed, rather than that simple hierarchical kind of control, what emerged was structural control over the workplace. This is where power becomes embedded in the structure of the work itself. And so there's a kind of technology to the work, and the technology imposes the rhythm. And certainly the image here would be of the assembly line, where, you know, you produce so many of such and such in such an amount of time, and that becomes the means of control over the worker. It's expected that, you know, you will turn out so many of so many wickets, or so many of this or that, or whatever it is that you're making. The work process imposes the rhythm. There tends to be a dividing up of a holistic kind of skill, so that rather than doing a whole, making a whole car or making a whole whatever, it's a certain segmented task that people do. And therefore, one of the things that becomes evident here is that sense of intrinsic worth of, you know, this is what I've done, becomes very segmented, and when it's hard to talk about, this is what I've created. Some people in recent years have advocated, you know, we really do need to build buildings where this corner of the building could be engraved with the names of the workers who work on that, rather than saying, well, yeah, I may put some piece of steel into this building, but, you know, I'm, you know, kind of one of the nameless laborers that just was working in with everyone else. But that loss of that holistic sense of, hey, this is what I created, and this therefore expresses who I am, which is I think intrinsic in that biblical notion of work as expressive of who we are. So with structural control, a lot of that begins to break down. The increasingly predominant form of control that Edwards suggests is present today is that of bureaucratic control, where there still is a kind of dynamic of control. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying control is all bad, you know, because I think we're recognizing the realities that, you know, companies have to make profit, et cetera, et cetera. And control is not an all bad kind of thing. But under bureaucratic control, what happens is that control becomes embedded in the social or organizational structure of the firm itself. Here it is, you know, the boss over the workers. Here it's the work process itself. Here it is the very structure of the firm that imposes the control. So, for example, there will be all kinds of anonymous company rules or policies. You know, it's not the manager or the foreperson or the boss who's saying you've got to do such and such, but it's the printed rules, the printed policies. This is the way we operate in this company. Very carefully delineated job classifications. And therefore, there's a sense in which it's more easy to predict what will happen to one if one doesn't somehow do one's job or measure up or whatever. Here, sometimes it's a bit more arbitrary, but here it's very clear that you know, you do such and such, and that will be grounds for firing you, or whatever. What emerges under this form of control is that power seems to emanate from the formal organization itself. One is made to feel part of the company family. The example that's often cited is if one works for a company like IBM, you know, there's a whole culture that becomes a part of one's life. There was a very bizarre TV program on about 6 months ago. It was a science fiction kind of thing, a whole family getting caught up into the, you know, the right health club and the, you know, the right, you know, this is what you do with your life because you're a part of this company. And one almost becomes a living, breathing part of whatever company it is. I think that, you know, to pick up on the, all of the dynamic connected with Tuesday night service, I think that was part of, you know, part of what makes people feel very comfortable, because then one begins to hear, hey, maybe this company is doing all this horrendous stuff in terms of doing business in South Africa or whatever. If one is a part of that, one feels so, you know, so much a part of that, that, you know, one can't really stand outside of it. You know, it becomes a total kind of environment. One becomes part of the company family. And the firm becomes, as it were, a social institution. Edwards sees this as the predominant kind of trend, which therefore means that the possibility of critique of what's going on becomes more remote. You know, here it's easier to say, well, yeah, it's an us versus them thing. You know, it's us workers and them bosses. And here also, especially because this has been the form of work in which unionism has especially prevailed, unionism being a very fading phenomenon in our country. The last figure I heard was 16% of the workforce is unionized. But here, you know, the high tech and other industries, it's not so much unions, but it's, you know, we take care of you, kind of company welfare, et cetera, kind of understanding. So the possibility of critique becomes much more difficult. And therefore, you know, I think we can't be too naive in terms of assuming that one can just kind of take out after that and lash out after that. Now, before I open this up to discussion, let me do put some columns down here. Both these pins are kind of, maybe this one's a little better. A little faded on all scores here. The three labor markets, or three sectors of the labor market that Edwards puts along the side here, are, first of all, the secondary labor market. And it is, this is the area of the workforce where simple hierarchical control still tends to prevail. Now, the secondary labor market consists most stereotypically of the fast food jobs, the jobs working in the discount department store. They tend to be more casual jobs, the kinds of jobs that college kids might think of having during their, while they're going through school, but the possibility of being in one of those jobs for the rest of one's life is usually not a very inviting kind of prospect. They're jobs where labor clearly is seen as a commodity. Usually the pay is not that great. Minimum wage, not always minimum wage even. Job security is not that great. There's not a lot of possibilities of career advancement. And there's likely to be a pretty high turnover in these jobs of the labor market. So in addition to fast food or discount department store clerks, there would be some lower level clerical jobs, jobs like guards, janitors, hospital workers, migrant agricultural workers, jobs of that type. It's, I think, extremely important from a justice perspective to realize that this is where women and minorities have disproportionately been located. Now, the assumption is that if, for example, this worker is a woman, that she's the second wage earner in the family, and she's just working to supplement the family income, to remember that good life cycle. She's working temporarily to pay off bills. That's the assumption. Now, if we look at the increasing number of single women wage earners, we realize that hey, if in fact that's where she finds work, she and her family are likely to be among the working poor. Because we're talking about minimum wage kinds of jobs, jobs without much security, jobs without possibilities of advancement, or at least advancement that's going to mean very much. And therefore, those who depend on this as their source of income for the family are indeed likely to be the working poor. And yet, these are the jobs of last resort. And so that many people who have those jobs, they know that, hey, if I lose that job, I'll be among that pool of unemployed. And that pool of unemployed are always there to remind them, hey, if you really don't want to put up with that job, there's somebody else who would love to have that job at McDonald's or whatever. Now, the primary labor market consists of two sectors. And I recognize that these have very hierarchical terms connected with them, but in a sense, Edwards is purposely using both categories like this. The first type of primary labor market are subordinate primary labor market workers. And these would most typically be the unionized working class jobs in our society, jobs in factories, in offices, jobs that are therefore less subject to arbitrary firings, where there are some patterns of advancement. But even though there is more job security, that in and of itself is not that sure either, especially in our present era of plant closings and the like. Because even though there is that possibility of having some protection against being arbitrarily fired if the whole company is closing, the lack of plant closing legislation in this country, for the most part, unlike most European countries, one can be pretty vulnerable in that part of the labor market also. So those would be jobs that typically have operated with structural control, the assembly line kind of process, or a lot of the studies that indicate, you know, that the office really is becoming mechanized in ways very similar to the ways in which factories are. And there's a kind of structural control of the, you know, the computers and the word processors and all the mechanization and all the capital intensive kinds of investments to make an office run in our day, that it really is a structural control that is operating there. So these are not just blue collar jobs, there are a lot of white collar jobs also. Yeah, the third, let me put some numbers here. The third part of the labor market is the, let's see, what does, let me just check and see what he calls this. I can't think of the exact title right now, but it's the dominant or the independent primary labor market. I think that's the word he uses. These would include such things as skilled clerical sales and technical workers, especially those jobs that involve independence, initiative, and self-pacing to a far greater degree than those who are in this sector here. This also would involve craft workers in trades, and certainly the whole pool of professionals and a lot of public sector workers, managers, etc., the whole proliferation of jobs in the public sector that occurred after World War II, even though there have been some sharp cutbacks in many of those jobs since 1980. So they definitely are the jobs that do have more independence. Interestingly enough, studies indicate that this is the job sector that is 70% white males. So there definitely is a very difference, some very real differences as to who is in this job sector and who is in this job sector. Here, the predominant form of control tends to be that of bureaucratic control. And yet, I think what has happened for most of us who find ourselves working in this part of the labor sector, and I think that also includes church professionals insofar as the church can become a bureaucracy at times, is that we see ourselves in some ways as having made it. And, you know, even though we might be critical of that good life cycle, we realize, hey, you know, we bought into that too to some degree. And yet, as people in these jobs now begin to find themselves out of work or disillusioned, etc., that very cultural ethos that causes us to set ourselves over against those who haven't made it make it very difficult for us to see our interests as having something in common with these others. In other words, we're set apart from one another, which again I think becomes the theological challenge of how can we overcome those ways in which we don't stand together with one another, but we get pit against one another again and again. I think what's been interesting is some of the stuff that's begun to happen in terms of the promise of high tech, because certainly high tech, we've been led to believe, will replace many of the jobs that are being lost in manufacturing in this particular sector of the job market. And yet studies increasingly are showing that it's a pretty small percentage of people that are moving into those high-tech jobs. In fact, I'm not sure where I picked it up, but I just last night was reading a study done by an organization in the Silicon Valley in California. And it was a study of the increasing number of laid-off workers in the high-tech industries. And they did a comparative study of those who were finding themselves laid off from high-tech industries in Scotland, in a Silicon Valley-type place there, and in Silicon Valley in California. And first of all, it's interesting because the average amount of time that these workers had been at their job was something like 3.4 years, so a pretty short span of time. 75% had been at their last job, the job from which they'd been laid off, less than 5 years. Those who are laid off tend to be those who are over the age of 35, whereas those who resign in order to find jobs in other comparable industries tend to be under the age of 35. In other words, very much a young person's kind of labor market.
The age keeps going down, doesn't it?
Yeah, 35. Long over the hill already. 69% were committed to their former employer, but only 38% believe that their former employer was committed to them. The majority were confident that their jobs were secure, and yet find themselves without work now. And then the study went on to document some of the impact of job loss on their personal belief system, and the degree to which all kinds of disillusionment and cynicism emerged, although there also were some positive impacts on their personal belief system. For example, people became a bit more important in their lives than had been the case before they lost their job, whether those people were their family and friends or even some of their former colleagues at work. So the study concludes that if we look at, the study, which is done from inside the industry, which is why I think it's interesting and it gives it a bit more credibility than just someone who's trying to be critical of high tech from the outside. It concludes that when we talk about high tech workers, we're talking about people who are involved with an impermanence of products and an impermanence of employers and impermanence among employees. In other words, it's all changing. It's very transient. It's a quick-moving kind of thing. And therefore, the kind of stability and the meaning, et cetera, that people had looked for in their jobs is kind of dissipates, and it's not there in the way that people had hoped it would be. Let me stop for a moment now, or for a while, and get your reactions, both in terms of whether this way of charting out what's happening to work makes sense to you, but also I would really appreciate some of the kinds of experiences and perspectives that you all have as to what is happening to work, because I don't think this is a simple kind of phenomenon that we can, that we can in any way try to understand with just a diagram like this, but I think we need lots of ways of trying to understand what's going on. What are you experiencing or perceiving or hearing? Ed?
Did Edwards deal with a shift to the service economy?
Mm-hmm.
That would take your losses that you spoke of in the secondary
second category,
and move them not necessarily to high tech, but to the service economy, which is a downward.
That's right.
Downward trend.
Yeah.
And indeed, there's been a lot of writing about that thing. The lead article in last Friday's Wall Street Journal dealt with a steel worker and his son, and where the son went, and the fact that he was less secure, making less, working longer, but more satisfied. So that the issue of satisfaction and things other than money is on the table, not just in places like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very real, and I appreciate it. I wanted to mention that, the myth is that, well, I've really done this the reverse way. I should have second in the bottom or make it look up. But myth is that there will be this upwardly mobile thing, and yet, as these get crossed out, it goes increasingly this. In fact, I have an interesting statistic here. In the Midwest, there has, in recent years, and I don't know what amount of time this is talking about, but just recently, been a $31 billion loss in aggregate wages as factory workers increasingly are having to resort to jobs in the secondary labor market. So we're talking about, you know, steel workers who are earning $15, $20 an hour or whatever, earning the minimum wage after waiting out for a while and hoping that they'd be called back, and all of a sudden, you know, one-fourth the income of what they were used to previously. So that's, you know, I think an increasingly serious kind of phenomena. And, you know, and that is this whole proliferation of service sector jobs, some of which have a bit more stability and security than some of those stereotypical secondary ones, but many of them don't.
I think another thing that's happened is that as this goes on, there are increasing pressures for protection from external forces, mm-hmm. and protections particularly for increasing tariffs, which is impinging on international trade, mm-hmm. and particularly on third world countries, mm-hmm. which are dependent upon selling their resources to the American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that brings up a point that I think is worthy of note, that if you go back 50 years, you could sort of draw a box around your hometown and say, okay, what the forces that control what happens there are sort of understandable within there, mm-hmm. within the hometown. But it seems to me that now the forces that shape what goes on are from literally all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have the ability now to know in real time, literally real time, exactly what is going on all over the world. News, business dealings, the world of business can, if it chooses, run 24 hours a day, and there are those that try it. Going from one place to another around the world in real time. So the concept of what's going on in the world needs to get brought home to those who have to deal with the effects that are brought. You can't just pull up the tent around you and say, okay, it's all in the tent. It's not.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that that's true even in those areas of work that we tend to still have a fairly romantic kind of image of.
Uh-huh.
For example, in terms of farming.
Sure, absolutely, Karen.
And the I had a few observations here that I had jotted down by some folks I was talking with in Nebraska 2-3 weeks ago. And their contention is that this structural control kind of stuff has so much taken over the farming process, too. You know, motivated by the belief that bigger is better, you know, which is why so much farmland was bought in the late 70s at such high interest rates, et cetera. And the belief that technology can fix any problem. Three developments have occurred that parallel those in industry. Centralization of farming, specialization, focusing on certain crops, and a fragmentation of farming. So rather than the farmer raising the grain to feed the livestock and butchering the livestock, etc. That's all, you know, those are all done by totally different people in that farming community or even wider than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore that, you know, that whole notion of the self-sufficient farmer is, you know, such an increasing myth in the face of all of those huge kinds. And I think that's part of, you know, and I'm not an expert in the farm crisis, or as Chuck Canton, who works in this area in the ALC, says, no, he says, I want people not just think farm crisis, it's long-term huge changes that we're going to have to deal with. But at the same time, I'm just, you know, aware of the fact that it's so true there, too, even though we've had this romanticized notion of, well, that's where the independent, self-sufficient individualism can still prevail.
We had a dramatic example of that the last couple of months in California, where Knudsen's which is a combination of Hitson's and Foremost, defaulted on millions and millions of dollars worth of payments to dairy farmers, and so that they were behind over a month in their payments. Knutson's provides 25% of the milk and dairy products in California, which is a huge.
Yeah, they were on the verge of Chapter 11 last Friday.
So all of these farmers, as a result, really aren't independent at all.
That's right.
They can be knocked down by that quickly.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's
right. Most of my male friends in my field, especially the forestry that I know, are very unhappy with their jobs.
Uh-huh.
About half of them work for corporations, and half for the government. And the primary reason that they're unhappy is what you're talking about there is they have to follow the rules. And the farther they get up in the organization, the more rules they have to follow. Most of them don't like the rules. But they're stuck. They can't do anything about it.
And especially if they know that the rules don't make sense in terms of a certain thing. And they know enough about what they're doing to know
I had a really good friend that got up to be second in command in the corporation of accrediting his board members who couldn't stand the rules. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's 90% of professional foresters are like that. They don't like the rules.
And they have no input into what the rules are. So they have no state kind of decisions.
It's interesting, too, in this latest, the article on attorneys and the salaries that they're paying these new, just graduated attorneys at $65,000, $70,000 a year, but the treadmill that they put those people on and the quality of life was totally diminished to the point where you have to sacrifice one for the other.
Sell your soul.
That's exactly
you bet.
But the attorney could go out on his own.
But not to make $60,000.
Oh, no.
You make $15,000.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to turn the thing around. See, I've had a penny company career. It was a terrific career. I think we're kind of selling down the American opportunity in the belly to live in a country that's free. I think the thing that's happened is like the fellow working on a cathedral, and one fellow asked whether he's throwing brick. They said, I'm building a cathedral. Mm-hmm. I think Luther's conception of the call is something we've lost as individuals. When I graduated from St. Olaf, went on to graduate school, I met Mr. Penny. I met a man that I admired very much. I'd never changed my whole career. Mm-hmm. But here was a company where the golden rule was the rule. Not only with customers, which is smart business, not only with the employees, which is smart business, but with the manufacturer that they dealt with. And that is quite unusual. It's a company that has no unions. The only large company in the world in the United States that I know of that doesn't have a union. I'm going to a reunion. I've been retired for a few years. I'm going to a reunion in Seattle of retired Penny people, which is all volunteer. We stick because we work together and so on. And I get kind of sick of selling down of America and the opportunities and thinking in terms, I think we've come over to where we worship feminism and third world and all these things in our church from the standpoint of getting down to the real core of our religious faith and motivation, which should be individual relationship to Christ and our motivation in our calling as being from God, regardless of what your occupation is, that all occupations are sacred in the eyes of the Lord. But I think we've lost that particular thing, which to me is the most important. We've given that to our children because we feel that in America, we have the opportunity to do that. Many countries, you couldn't do that. I think when you mentioned sacrifice, I don't think sacrifice is wrong.
Oh, no, no,
you
I haven't, right.
In terms of sacrifice, if we don't give sacrificially, we aren't really giving. If we don't sacrifice for our kids, we aren't doing the right thing. If we didn't make it possible for them to go through school, college, get a start. And I think probably we get the cart before the horse in thinking in terms, I've been very offended by that service on Tuesday because I have dear friends who are executives and people in those corporations. And I know their devotion to the Lord, what they're doing in the work of the church. Who's built the colleges? Who built this place right here? I happen to know some of the people. Who built St. Olaf College, Cal Lutheran, Pacific Lutheran, so on. Those people who were devoted Christians who had a calling from the Lord, in business, made money, and were able to handle and manage it so that they could give to do these things, to make the seminaries possible, but this possible. And you have, and I think the matter of degrading profit. I now, in my retirement, work for the Lutheran Hospital Society of California. It's non-profit. But if we don't make a profit, we can't do anything for anybody. We can't build new hospitals. We can't. We have to have a profit, whether you're non-profit or what. You have to have a profit here, or pretty soon everything will go down and deteriorate. We won't have a fine place to meet here and discuss these issues. I think the matter of individual responsibility and commitment of the individual in who can get into government. We'll have Simon here, maybe he's here now. He's coming in, Senator Simon. Tremendous Christian political leader. We need more of these people, an aspiration to do that, not to stick down there working for you know, on a fast food outfit, but that's a good start. All of our kids, we encourage them, they had to go out and make their own spending money and have jobs, and that's good. And I think now too many of the kids don't, they think they're not going to work for $3 an hour, you know.
I want to make sure, you said a lot of, you know, important things, and it's hard to know what to pick up. Let me just say one thing, though. I don't want to be heard as saying that all this stuff is bad, you know, that profit is bad or individual responsibility and know-how is bad. My point, and I think that's what a number of us have been talking about here, is that those very good things, those very good intentions, you know, including that whole business of Luther's doctrine of vocation, which I think, you know, at its heart is good and valid. In all of the institutional realities and all the social economic dynamics that shape our present situation, those good intentions often don't help in terms of impacting that wider kind of situation. And therefore, what I as a theologian am continually trying to say, yeah, that individual relationship to God, that is extremely important, you know, and yeah, if in fact we could count on that being true of, you know, everyone in all these businesses, etc., yeah, maybe things would be different. But the fact of the matter is, there's all kinds of other dynamics impacting people's lives. And therefore, even the most well-meaning Christian, you know, at times doesn't, we need to be aware of some of these other factors also, which take our good intentions and sometimes turn them into something that's quite different from what we had intended.
Okay, we're to be.
So it's a matter of saying
world,
there's.
But not of the world. No matter what system you have. You see, if you think in terms of the system saving us, the system will not save us.
But I think what I hear you said, though, is that somehow the system and institutions need to be redeemed, too, if people are going
right.
to.
Right, but people have to do it. Individual people. With motivation that's from Christ, and that is because I've seen it work.
I'd like to
point out that the most of the jobs, the new jobs that are created, are created by the small businessman that's striking out on his own.
That's
and
right.
This has always been the case, and I think still will continue to be the case. Sure, General Motors and IBM have lots of employees, but if you add up all the employees in the country or the world, most of them are hired by small businessmen, mm-hmm. one, two, three, or four, and maybe they grow, maybe they don't. Mm-hmm. But and there's the possibility of the individual getting more security by leaving the big company and going out on his own, because the security is within yourself.
Yeah.
But even then, those small businesses are caught up in the midst of this big sea of all these other pressures and dynamics that...
And they get big. Ross Perot left IBM in 58 or so and founded EDS as a small business. And look what it is now.
Mary?
I just want to comment on a small business that I work for. We're trying to do an alternative kind of business. There are 9 employees. We all receive what we need. We tell the board what we need to live, because we believe it's a biblical precedent that you live with sufficiency, and if you take more than you need, you are stealing from someone else. So it's very strange, but if you work 10 hours or 40 hours, you get half of your medical insurance covered. We think there's biblical precedent for that somebody comes to the vineyard the last hour and still receives as much. There is no hierarchical structure. Everything is done on consensus. There isn't one big cheese that controls everything. And we have 40 volunteers besides 9 people who work on a stipend basis. The volunteers determine, it's a bookstore restaurant, so the volunteers determine where all the tips go. And that's $1,500 a month that goes to some hunger concern. People don't believe that you can run a business and make money by doing that kind of thing. But I think the reason it works is that people take ownership of the business. They really feel part of it. And when someone says, I need to go to counseling, maybe because they've been working there for a year, and they say, we need $60 more a month, we say, fine. We don't question and say, why are you asking for $60 more a month? They say, it's to pay for my counseling, or I totaled my car and I now need car payments. Someone else says, I'm now on rent subsidy, I can drop my stipend. So that wasn't in your on any of those kind of structural
things. That works too, Mary, because you're all committed to the same value system.
Well, and I don't think it's a naive thing, but then
no,
I just
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying you have that added strength and power to be committed to the same values.
But one, I just guess I want to point out that I think where the church needs to be active in vocation is especially in salaries. And I know this, I always get knocked down with good arguments when I say this, but why can't, if everybody said, this is what I need to live on, I think we'd be in a lot less trouble than we are now. And I just want to ask the gentleman who talked about the necessity for profits, how does a corporation make its profits? Who suffers because you make profits many times? I mean, I want to know where my money is being invested, if it's in South Africa or wherever it is. I know there's no pure place to stand, but I think someone that is very wealthy and says, I can be much more generous, I think I will be as generous if I made $100,000 a year as I would be if I made $10,000 a year. I tend to spend most of what John and I make, and I guess I would do that regardless of what our salary was. But I think we really have to be careful when we talk about it.
Yeah, I think that one of the important distinctions that from a Christian perspective we need to talk about when we talk about the whole profit business is, you know, as I was suggesting earlier, no, profits are important, okay? Yeah, and profits do help people. Some profits help people more than other profits. But I think it's that equation that tends to operate in corporate America it's continually the striving for the highest possible profit, without other concerns for community, et cetera, being factored into that. And
whatever system you have, selfishness gets in there.
It's greed.
Greed, and no matter whether it's this system or what system, in a matter of a fair profit, hey, you have to maintain, you have to make a little plus.
Right.
But
well, even
a fair profit.
Yeah, and even though green might enter into everyone, I think there are certain ways of structuring it that encourage more greed, or you know, the structure that Mary was suggesting, one that you know, really helps to move away from that. But again, you know, we're so caught up in
that. We have a hard time in large business or doing things that are need to be done if everything was at that level.
Well,
it's an ideal thing if we could live in small communities. And that's why it's easy in a small town, you know, things are a lot easier. But you get in a city and it gets pretty complicated. You've got to have a lot of things that you don't have in a small town. You can walk every place. In a large city, you have to have.
As a vocational instructor, and dealing with students that are supposedly going to be going out of the workforce, it's really hard to look at one job that society says is very important that we have and pays at such a rate versus another job that society says is very important.